Well, brethren, have you ever had a situation where everything seemed bleak? Whereas you surveyed the situation you might be facing or the situation you were in, just everything seemed dark, seemed clouded. Had an interesting situation a number of years ago visiting a cave. Now, personally, I don't like caves. I think people who go into caves have something loose. Why would you intentionally crawl into the ground someplace underneath there where it's very dark and damp? Now, if you're a spelunker, I don't mean to offend you. But we walked down in this cave, and it was light. The reason it was light is because someone many years ago had strung electricity from the surface down into this cave. And every so often there was a large light. So there were steps, there was a light, fairly easy to get down. And as the park ranger began, as you got down to this large room at least the place I was going to stop, he was explaining how we're now several hundred feet below the surface. And it is completely dark down here. And what was fascinating is he explained that if it were not for these lights, you would not be able to see literally the hand in front of your face. And so he said, let me demonstrate. Now I'm going to turn the lights out. And I want all of you to know that you will see absolutely nothing. And some of you will panic. The lights will only be out for a few moments, but we want you to see how dark it is down here. So sure enough, the lights went off, and it was terrifying. Like, who on earth, who found this place, and why would they crawl into the ground like this? It just didn't make any sense to me. But he said, this is how dark it normally is in here. You could hear his voice, and everything was fine. You didn't move, but it was frightening. All I wanted at that point was a little hope, a little speck of light, because my first thought was, what if the switch broke? And now we're down here. Now, he's walked up and down here 100 times, but the lights have always been on. Could he get us out of here if the lights were off? And I mean off, and not coming back on. So, of course, that fear proved to be unfounded because he turned the lights back on, everything's fine. The point was, just wanted a little speck of light, a little hope to make things okay. Well, as you know, the earth was in that exact circumstance. If you turn with me back to Genesis chapter 6, we are ready to begin series number 18 in the Genesis Foundational Knowledge series of sermons that we've been doing. And I'll mention again that if you have not been able to be a part of the first 17 of these sermons, they do stand by themselves with instruction and knowledge, so you don't have to have had all 17 previous ones to gain benefit, we hope, and important spiritual lessons from number 18. But after 17, we're ready for number 18. It is continually amazing in this book of origins, which is what Genesis means, origins, what we learn, the things that God lays down, frankly, in the first 10 or 11 chapters of the book are pretty astounding knowledge. So we are ready for number 18. 18 part 1, 18.1, as we've been numbering the sermons in recent days. What do we learn from this section of Genesis we're ready to pick up today? That is Noah's day, point 18.1, Noah's day and the end time are alike. Noah's day and the end time are alike. Here in Genesis chapter 6, we'll begin reading in verse 7. Then the Lord saw, God saw, that the wickedness of man was great in the earth. Now, you're beginning already in your mind to draw certain parallels between what your knowledge is of the end time and what we're reading here. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and as we covered last time, every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. This intense self-focus, self-ishness, as we talked about. The Lord was sorry he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. I liken that almost to that moment when the lights in the cave were shut off and it was absolute darkness. And as we said before, it's not that people didn't do nice things occasionally for each other, but the intent of the heart was self-seeking. The good that was often done was for selfish motive, for self-promotion. Verse 7, so the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I've created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing, birds of the air, for I'm sorry I have made them. What a tragic situation. So we get a snapshot of what life was like at the time of Noah. If you drop down to verse 11, we read more about Noah's day. The earth was also corrupt before God. The earth was filled with violence. So God looked upon the earth, and indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. Behold, I will destroy them from the earth. We might say the cave darkness had settled, and there was no hope, it seemed. Now, we'll pause there for a moment. We'll talk about Noah himself a little bit later on. But we made the statement that Noah's day and the end time are alike. What is recorded specifically here in Genesis 6 as the characteristics of Noah's day? We read through them, but we didn't take a lot of time to focus on them specifically. The first recorded characteristic of Noah's day is that human wickedness was great. Human wickedness was great. The second thing, we read that in verse 5, God saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth. Then, the second characteristic, humans were completely selfish and self-serving. During Noah's time, humans were completely selfish and self-serving. That's what verse 5 says. Every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Constantly seeing how to boost self, how to get for self, how to take care of self. Third characteristic, humans were corrupt. The earth was also corrupt before God in verse 11. All flesh had corrupted their way in verse 12. So humans were corrupt. Now we'll pause for a moment to ask, what does that mean, humans were corrupt? We think of corruption today, usually in political terms, where a corrupt politician will receive benefits for making laws or doing favors for others. So we talk about government corruption. The Hebrew word does not mean that. It simply means to destroy, to corrupt, to go to ruin, to decay. Humans morally were in complete decay. They had walked away from God's law, his way, and as a result they became morally corrupt. The Hebrew word literally means to destroy, corrupt, go to ruin, decay, to be marred, spoiled, corrupted, to be corrupt. When you leave fruit out for 6 weeks, it becomes corrupt. That's the kind of corruption described here. When a body is dead for a while, it goes to corruption. It decays. That's what's being talked about. So moral decay is another way to put that. Humans were morally decayed. They're not keeping God's law. Another Hebrew scholar renders this word to spoil, ruin, pervert, corrupt, destroy. To be spoiled. So that gives you an idea of what it was like during Noah's time. Humans were morally bankrupt. Self-serving in every way. They were corrupt. In decay morally. And then the fourth characteristic listed here in Genesis 6 about Noah's day was the earth was filled with violence. Verse 11 simply says that. The earth was filled with violence. Verse 13 says the exact same words. The earth is filled with violence. The Hebrew word means violence. It means wrongs. It means cruelty. It means injustice. It means oppression. So, what do the Scriptures then reveal about Noah's time? Humans were wicked, they were completely selfish and self-serving, they were morally corrupt, and the earth therefore was filled with violence. Now, when we ask ourselves, what are the characteristics of the end time, do we find the same thing? Well, go ahead and put your marker here in Genesis chapter 6, and turn with me to Matthew chapter 24. What do the Scriptures reveal about the end time? Matthew 24 is certainly one of the most famous prophecies about the end time. Christ was warning His disciples what to look for, what to watch for, what to be wary of. Matthew 24 and verse 36. As we read through this end time description, ask yourself, does this parallel the day of Noah? And therefore, does it give us an idea what to look for, what to watch out for? Matthew 24, we'll pick it up in verse 36. There's more we could read, but we'll pick it up here. Matthew 24 and verse 36, "But of that day and hour," meaning when Christ will come back to the earth, "of that day and hour knows no one, not even the angels of heaven, but my Father only." Now, Christ just got done talking about the fig tree. And when the fig tree puts out leaves and starts to blossom, you know that summer's close. So there are indications that lead us to understanding when the end time might be. But he says the exact time of Christ's return, nobody knows. It hasn't been revealed just yet, at least to us. Verse 37. Then it says something unique. "But as the days of Noah were..." So what's the context in which Christ is saying this? Nobody knows exactly when Christ will return, but here's some indicators. "Just like the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man." So why is it important to understand what was going on in Noah's day? So that we can know the general time that Christ will return, so that we can be ready, so that we can be watchful. "But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man." So what were those characteristics that we looked at? Well, human wickedness was great. Humans were completely selfish and self-serving. Humans were corrupt. And the earth was filled with violence. So as those characteristics engulf the earth and grow to a crescendo, we will see Christ's return. Verse 37 again. "But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be." Verse 38. Then he goes on to explain more. So Christ Himself actually reveals more about the days of Noah than was recorded by Noah, or by, I should say, Moses in Genesis 6. He adds something that's not there. He says this in verse 38. "For as in the days of the flood, before the flood, they were eating and drinking." Moses does not mention eating and drinking during the time of Noah. Goes on to say, "marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark." What is Christ's point? You can't know the time yet, but there are indications. When the situation is like the days of Noah, you know it's very close. Then he says, those were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage. What's his point? The point is, it will be surprising when the time comes. Most people will be taken by surprise. Will they have a sense that something might be up? Well, sure, that's possible. When you have Noah building this giant boat, did people have a sense that something might have been up? Certainly they could have. At the same time, they just went about their lives in a normal fashion. That's what Christ is intending. They were going about their normal lives the way they did things And it took them completely by surprise. Time and time again, Christ warns that the end time will take people by surprise. Just as the flood took people in Noah's day by surprise. They did not know, verse 39, until the flood came and took them all away. So also will the coming of the Son of Man be. It will take most people by surprise. So much so that in verse 40 he says, then two men will be in the field, one taken, the other left. Two women grinding at the mill, one taken, the other left. So watch therefore, verse 42, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. Noah and his children were taken. All the others were left. They were taken by surprise. They were drowned in the flood. So we learn about the days of Noah that most people completely ignored any warning signs and they went about their selfish lives like they normally would. They ate, they drank, they married, they gave in marriage. That's the way life was until they died in the flood. So he says, watch, verse 42, therefore, for you do not know what hour your Lord is coming. That goes right back to verse 36. No one knows the day and the hour that Christ is coming. So that's the context of what's being described here. Verse 43, but know this. Again, you don't know when he's coming. It's going to be a surprise. Noah did not honestly know when the flood was going to occur. The boat was finished. But don't know this. This is something we can know. That if the master of the house had known what hour the thief would come, he would have watched and not allowed his house to be broken into you. In other words, you know there's a thief in the neighborhood. Watch out for him. So you can keep your house safe. That's the analogy. What does a thief usually do? A thief usually surprises us at a time we don't expect. That's the context. Time and again. It will come when you least expect it. So watch so you can be ready. Will we have a general idea of the time period? Absolutely. Will we know exactly? No. Watch and be ready. So verse 44, here's the point. Therefore, you also be ready. You don't know when Christ is going to return. He's going to come and surprise most of the world like a thief does in the middle of the night. So be ready. Verse 44, therefore you also be ready, for the Son of Man is coming in an hour you do not expect. Now who is Christ speaking to? He is speaking to his disciples in this chapter. So he's saying you just have to be in a constant state of readiness. Because you just don't know when it will happen. So like the days of Noah, they should have been watching. They should have been in a state of honor toward God and readiness. But they were not, and therefore the flood took them by surprise. In the same way, people today will go about their lives eating and drinking, marrying and giving, living their lives, and it will take them by surprise. So the day of Noah is like the end time, or vice versa, we could say. Verse 47, or verse 46. Let's back up to verse 45. We haven't read that yet. Who then is a faithful and wise servant whom his master made ruler over his household to give them food in due season? Blessed is that servant whom his master, when he comes, will find so doing. Being ready. Verse 47, assuredly I say to you, he will make him ruler over all his goods. But if that evil servant says in his heart, my master delays his coming, begins to beat his fellow servants, to eat and drink with the drunkards, in other words, eating and drinking, marrying, and just living life, fulfilling selfish desires, if that's what we turn into, verse 50, the master of that servant will come on a day when he was not looking for him, and an hour when he's not aware of. That's what will happen to the world. We need to be sure it doesn't happen to us. Verse 51. And we'll cut him in two and appoint him his petition, or his portion, I should say, with the hypocrites. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. The day of Noah and the end time are alike, in that people simply go on living their own lives. They might be relatively decent people. They might be completely decadent people. But they just go about living their own selfish lives. And the end time will catch them by surprise. We're told to watch. Now, I'd like to read with you Mark's version of this same statement, these same statements of Christ in Mark 13. Let's take a look at that, because here we're given a little bit slightly different perspective on Christ's words. Mark chapter 13, beginning in verse 32. The context is the same. It's the same speech, we might say, by Christ that Mark is writing down here. In verse 32 of Mark 13, he writes, "But of that day and hour knows no one, not even the angels in heaven, nor the Son, but only the Father. The exact time of Christ's return is not yet available to anyone but the Father." He'll make that decision. Verse 33. If that's the case, if we don't know when He's coming, verse 33 says, "Take heed and watch and pray. Be ready yourself. Take heed and watch and pray, for you do not know when the time is." The context is surprise. The context is you don't know, so be ready, so you're not taken completely off guard. Verse 34, "It's like a man going to a far country," so he tells this story, "It's like a man going to a far country who left his house and gave authority to his servants and to each his work and commanded the doorkeeper to watch." Do the job, watch. Verse 33, verse 35, "Watch therefore, for you do not know when the master of the house is coming. In the evening, at midnight, at the crowing of the rooster, or in the morning. Lest coming suddenly," context is always Christ's return will be a surprise, "don't be caught unawares." So verse 36, "Lest coming suddenly he find you sleeping. And what I say to you all, I say to all," that means us, "watch." What should the people of Noah's day have been doing? They should have been watching. Watching for what? Rain clouds? What do we watch for? Rain clouds? Watch what? The primary emphasis is to watch ourselves. Yes, we should watch world events. We should see the fig tree, and if the leaves are coming out, yes, that's true. But what is the situation here? You don't want to be sleeping. Watch. Watch yourself. If you turn into that servant who beats others and doesn't take care of your own business, you're not watching. So the primary emphasis of watching is watch yourself. Don't turn into that servant who says, "My master delays his coming," who beats his fellow servants and doesn't care for them, who drinks with the drunkards. Watch yourself. Of course, watch world events. You bet. But watch yourself first. Turn over to Luke's account of this same thing. Luke adds quite a bit. Actually, Luke places this speech of Christ in a little bit different order than Matthew and Mark do. Luke chapter 17, beginning in verse 26. Now, it may be that Christ stated this on several occasions, because normally when we read Matthew 24 and we read Mark 13, that's all paralleled with Luke chapter 21. But Luke includes this story back in Luke chapter 17. So it may be that Christ spoke this on several occasions, or Luke just felt it fit better in his telling of the story in this location. We'll just pick it up in Luke 17 and verse 26. Now, leading up to that, of course, the Pharisees ask him about when the kingdom would be coming. He addresses the disciples directly, but we'll pick it up in verse 26. "And as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man." So that parallel between Noah's day and our day today, or the end time. Verse 27. "They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage, until the day that Noah entered the ark, and the flood came and destroyed them all. They went about their normal business." Just their normal business. So, days of Noah, end time the same. Verse 28. Likewise. What is his emphasis? His emphasis is surprise. Be ready, because it's going to be a surprise. In the same way it was a surprise to the people who lived during the day of Noah that this destruction came out of nowhere, he says in verse 28, likewise, or in the same way, as it was also in the days of Lot. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. What's his emphasis? Life is just going on. I'm just doing my own thing, just taking care of myself. Self-interest, self-focus, selfishness. We would certainly be able to say as a result of this parallel that for some reason Matthew and Mark didn't include Lot and Sodom and Gomorrah in his telling of the story, or their telling of the story. Luke does. We could say that as it was in the days of Noah, and as it was in the days of Sodom and Gomorrah, so shall it be in the days of the Son of Man. Luke puts that together here. Likewise, as it was in the days of Lot, they went about their normal selfish lives. They ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. They just went about their lives. They were in a morally corrupted state, but they just went about their lives. Different people at different levels of immorality, different levels of corruption, different levels of selfishness, but all in the same boat. Verse 29. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. What was the point? They weren't watching. They weren't ready. And they were surprised. They were destroyed. Verse 30. He just talked about the days of Noah. Now he talks about the days of Lot. Then he says the summary in verse 30. Even so, in the same way, so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed. So his point, watch. Be ready. Why did all those thousands, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions, die in the flood? They weren't watching. They weren't ready. Why did the residents of Sodom and Gomorrah die with fire and brimstone? They weren't watching. They weren't ready. What will happen in the end time? Those that will die will not be watching. They will not be ready. Now turn over to Luke chapter 21. Luke chapter 21. Beginning in verse 34. As we mentioned, Matthew 24, Mark chapter 13, and Luke 21 are their recordings of this instruction by Christ, of this great end time prophecy. What to be watching for in the future. Not just watching yourselves, but what other signs should be watching for. So Luke adds something that was also recorded in Matthew, writes about it a little bit differently, gives us an interesting perspective on that, some more encouragement. In Luke 21, verse 34, Luke 21 down in verse 34, he just gets done recording this parable of the fig tree. Leaves will come out. You'll know something's up. You'll know it's close. Verse 34. But take heed to yourselves. What should be watching? We should be watching ourselves. What has Mr. Armstrong for decades taught us? What's the purpose of being a Christian? To build holy, righteous character. To be ready. Take heed to yourselves, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing and drunkenness and the cares of this life. He doesn't say, take heed to yourselves, lest you not recognize which 12 kings, 10 kings, will be in the final conglomeration of the beast power. That's important. But it's not nearly as important as what Christ is saying here. Take heed to yourself, lest your hearts be weighed down with everyday living. Carousing, drunkenness. What do we read about in the days of Noah? Marrying, giving in marriage. Sodom, drinking. Days of Noah, drinking, eating, marrying, giving in marriage. Just the everyday cares of life. Just going about our selfish lives. As if this life were all there was to it. That's the problem. Take heed to yourselves, verse 34, lest your hearts be weighed down with carousing, drunkenness, and the cares of this life, and that day come on you unexpectedly. Surprise is the constant theme. It will take us all by surprise. unless we're watching, unless we're prepared. I kind of get the feeling that Christ is saying, be like a soldier. Be ready. Be trained. Be spiritually fit. Be militarily, in a spiritual sense, prepared. Does a soldier know when the attack is coming? No. So he or she has to be ready for that time. Christians will not know when Christ will return, but they will be ready. They'll be prepared so that when the first shell strikes, they are at ready and they have their weapons in their hand and their armor is on and the sword of God's word is in their hand because they've been practicing with it. They know it. That's what's being described here. The day of the Lord will come on you unexpectedly. We'll have the general idea of when the time will be. And if we're ready, we will be ready when the alarm is sounded. Verse 35. For it will come, the day of the Lord. It will come as a snare on all those who dwell on the face of the whole earth. As it was in the days of Noah, so shall it be the day of the Son of Man. It will come as a snare. A snare is a trap. It will snap down. We've had in our garage a little mouse problem recently. We have three less mice in our mouse problem because a trap was set and it snapped on them completely unaware. That's what's being described here. Not that people are mice or rats. The point is, if we're not watching ourselves, if we're not in a state of readiness for the return of Christ, it will come as a snare. All of a sudden, it will explode onto the earth. And it will be a snare, a trap. Now, do animals who go into a snare sometimes have a sense that something is up? Oh, absolutely. Many times, I have shot deer who know something's up, but they don't know exactly what or where or when. Very cautious, they've scented something, they know something's up, but they basically go about what they're doing. Maybe a little more cautiously. Will the world be like that? Some people will be. There's something's wrong, something's up, I'm not sure what it is, and the trap will fall. The snare will be sprung. It will come as a snare because they're not watching, they're morally corrupt, they're self-centered, and they will be caught in the snare. Verse 36, watch therefore. That's our job. When we learn from the day of Noah and how it's like the end time, Christ several times, verse 36, says watch. That's the solution. Watch therefore. Who was watching in Noah's day? Only one man, Noah. We read last time, Noah found grace in the sight of the Eternal. Why? Because he was watching. He understood. He was watching first and foremost himself, and then listening to God's instruction, being obedient to God. Watch therefore, verse 36, therefore, and pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape. It's going to be an escape. Now, when we think of escape, we don't think of kind of waltzing down the street. When you escape from something, you get out by the skin of your teeth, it seems. That you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and stand before the Son of Man. So Noah's day is like the end time. Let's look at one other New Testament scripture in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Not only did Christ write about these things or speak about these things and have them written down, the Apostle Paul took his cue apparently from those things and very likely from the instruction that Christ personally gave him. And he likewise then cautions us as the church to be ready. He doesn't specifically mention Noah, but he cautions us to be ready. 1 Thessalonians 5 in verses 1 through 9. When we go through these scriptures, it can help us to reevaluate the priorities in our life. And are we in a state of readiness? Is our habit and our routine in a state of readiness? 1 Thessalonians 5 in verse 1. Paul wrote specifically to this church because they misunderstood, it seemed, when Christ would return. Some had quit their jobs and were kind of sitting around waiting for the Messiah to return, waiting for their position in the family, in the kingdom. Christ said, get ready. Don't sit around. So, verse 1, Paul writes, "But concerning the times and the seasons, brethren, you have no need that I should write to you." It was an urgent time. "For you yourselves," verse 2, "know perfectly that the day of the Lord so comes as a thief in the night." Where did Paul get that? Well, we just read that. Got it from Christ's own words, telling you that it's going to come like a thief in the night. What are most people doing in the middle of the night? They're sleeping. Who's up? Only the watchman. What are we told to do? We're told to watch. Be ready. 4, verse 3, "When they say peace and safety, then sudden destruction comes upon them, as labor pains upon a pregnant woman, and they shall not escape." One of the most famous photographs of all time, probably, is when Prime Minister Chamberlain returned from a conference to Britain from Germany after a conference with Adolf Hitler. And he held up a document and proclaimed to the press, "Peace in our time." Of course, you know what the result was. World War II and hundreds, literally millions upon millions of lives lost. That's peace in our time? I don't think so. Not at all. So, when someone says, "We've got the most peaceful time we've ever had," look out. That's one of those leaves on the fig tree we'll be watching for. Just like labor pains upon a pregnant woman. When those labor pains come, it's time for the baby. You're not going to stop it. You can't cross your legs and say, "Pains go away." That baby's coming, one way or another. Verse 4, "But you..." Okay, not those who are asleep, not those who are sleeping when the thief comes, but the watchmen, verse 4, "But you brethren are not in darkness, so that this day should overtake you as a thief. You are all sons of light, sons of the day. We are not of the night or darkness. Therefore, let us not sleep as others do, but let us watch and be sober." Priorities must be right. Watch, be sober. It doesn't mean we don't have a sense of humor, but we're serious about our calling. Serious about being obedient to God, doing God's way, living God's way, teaching God's way. Verse 7, "For those who sleep, sleep at night, and those who get drunk are drunk at night. But let us, who are of the day, be sober, putting on the breastplate of faith and love, and as a helmet, the hope of salvation." That's why we used that soldier analogy a few moments ago. Paul is saying, be ready. Be girded up with your armor on. Verse 9, "For God did not appoint us to wrath," in other words, His anger, "but to obtain salvation through our Lord Jesus Christ, who died for us, that whether we wake or sleep, we should live together with Him. Therefore, comfort each other and edify one another, just as you are also doing." Take this knowledge, encourage each other. Edify one, encourage each other to watch. So, can we draw the parallel that at the end time, there will be great human wickedness? Do we feel that we see that today? I think we could say that. Human wickedness is great in the earth. People simply living their own lives, living out selfishly. Will humans today, are they today, pretty much completely self-serving and selfish? We'd say that. Now, again, sometimes you have to take this in context. People will say, "Well, you know, I'm a part of this really great club, and they're very nice. They do nice things. Maybe it's the JCs. Maybe it's the Rotary. Maybe it's this. Maybe it's that." Certainly people can do nice things. Well, what about those who aren't a part of those clubs? What's the attitude of those in the club toward those outside the club? It's interesting to see how much competition and other things come into play. Is the humanity on the earth corrupt? Or are they righteous? Are they all lights on the hill of living God's way, of being obedient to God? I was listening to a lecture recently on a survey of the Old Testament. And it's fascinating because the fella, doctor in education, was talking about Genesis. And one of the things he was mentioning is just how important it is when you look at Genesis that God does the creation. And he talked about how God rested at the end of the week. God rested. The Sabbath day, he said, is vitally important. Everyone needs to rest. And he went on describing how important it was to be sure you take that day of rest. So he says, when you send your kids to Sunday school, be sure you're resting. And they're thinking, wait a second. How did Sabbath get turned into Sunday? Well, just selfishly going about his own. That's what we believe. So even the ones that are supposed to be, quote unquote, good, are teaching absolute lies and falsehoods. It's tragic. Absolutely tragic. Is the earth filled with violence today? Cruelty, injustice, oppression, wrong? I was going to this morning just say, let me just turn the paper open to the front page and read it to you. But I thought, it's so depressing. Why would I want to do that? Because what are the lead stories? These absolutely wicked individuals who have perverted their sexual behaviors with all kinds of people. Just disgusting things. We're told to watch. The earth will be taken by surprise by the end time events. We will be surprised as well. You know how ready you can be and still be taken by surprise? Every time that I've been to a presentation of the 1812 Overture, I know when those cannons are going to go off. I'm ready for it. It always just rattles you. So you can be ready, but still it takes you by surprise. So, point 18.1, Noah's Day and the end time are alike. Point 18.2, we'll have time to cover one more issue here. Point 18.2, we must be like Noah. We must be like Noah. Let's look a little bit at Noah, the man. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 8. Genesis 6 and verse 8, we've read this before. We've said it's one of the most comforting scriptures of the Bible after one of the most frightening scriptures of the Bible, one of the saddest scriptures of the Bible, where God says, I'm just sorry I made man. We have one of the most encouraging verses, verse 8, But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. Why? Why did Noah find grace? Wouldn't we read this and say, I want God to find me in that same state. I want to have the grace of God. I want to have the good favor of God. Why did Noah have God's good favor or the grace of the Eternal? Well, let's look over a few things. Genesis chapter 7 and verse 1. Genesis 7 and verse 1. We'll come back to Genesis 6 in a few moments. Then the Lord said to Noah, Genesis 7, verse 1, come into the ark, you and all your household. Why? Why did Noah receive this special favor? Because I have seen that you are righteous before me in this generation. Out of everybody on the earth, Noah was that light, that little peak of light in the dark cave. Showed a way out. Now, no one else followed him. And again, he took his family along. God was gracious to him in that sense. Because of his obedience, his family was spared as well. That was very kind. Why did Noah find grace? Because he was righteous. Now, David defines righteousness. He says, all your commandments are righteous. Or righteousness. So we understand Noah had to have been obedient to God. Put a finger here, or a card. Turn to 2 Peter. There are several times in the Bible that the Bible refers to Noah as a man. Genesis 7:1 says he was righteous. What is 2 Peter 2? in verse 5 say? 2 Peter 2 and verse 5. Here Peter is writing again, as you know, about these depraved individuals who were teaching falsehoods, who were taking advantage of the church. And Peter's reminding the brethren that God will punish and take care of these things when the time is right. And he offers as proof that God will act at the perfect time. He offers as proof, first, God dealt with Satan and the angels, the rebellious demons. And then the second example he uses in 2 Peter 2 and verse 5, and the second example, he did not spare the ancient world, but saved Noah, one of eight people. And then what does it say about Noah? A preacher of righteousness. And of course, bringing in the flood on the world of the ungodly. So it's clear that Noah was not ungodly. He was a preacher of righteousness. So far, we've seen Noah was righteous, and he was a preacher of righteousness. He was not afraid to tell people what the truth was. Not in an offensive manner, probably, but he was not afraid to do that. He was telling people what God would do. Now, there's another statement in Ezekiel chapter 14 that talks about Noah. Says he was righteous in Genesis 7:1. He was a preacher of righteousness in 2 Peter 2:5. Ezekiel 14 gives us additional insight about Noah. In fact, in this case, frames Noah together with Daniel and with Job. Why did Noah find grace in the eyes of the Lord? Because he was righteous. Because he was a preacher of righteousness. And our culture does everything it can to suppress you being a preacher of righteousness. Oh, you're judgmental. Oh, you're too hard-nosed. Oh, you believe your way is the only way that's right. You know, we would answer yes to all those questions. Sorry. But all those things are true. It's just the way it is. Not that we don't love you, but you're wrong. You know, go on from there. Ezekiel 14 in verse 12. The word of the Lord came again to me. So this is God's specific word to Ezekiel saying this: Son of man, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. Why does the Church of God today teach that America will fall? For this reason. Now some will say, well, we're stronger than we've ever been. Well, it can appear that way on the outskirts, on the surface. Got a great analogy. My brother-in-law in Texas, he and his wife have a home. And a few years back, they saw little crumblings of wood in one of the bedroom floors. So, well, that's kind of odd. And as they moved the furniture away to take a look at what was going on, there was a wooden beam that supported the window and then the roof above that. And as he pressed upon this wooden beam, it completely collapsed because there was nothing there, literally nothing there, but the paint that had been used to paint this board. Termites had eaten it away completely. So, several thousands of dollars and a week or two of labor later, everything was back to normal. But what's so fascinating is if you look at it, it looks exactly perfect. And that's often what our culture looks like. It's what our nation looks like. It is being eaten away from the inside out. It looks okay on the surface, but it is going to fall and fall hard. Fall in a tremendous crash. Son of man, verse 13, when a land sins against me by persistent unfaithfulness, I will stretch out my hand against it. I will cut off its supply of bread, send famine on it, cut off man and beast from it. It's going to happen. And even verse 14, if these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they would deliver only themselves, notice this, by their righteousness. So, in the midst of an unrighteous people, an unrighteous land, a righteous man or woman will be delivered. We read earlier about the story of Lot. He was the only one striving to obey God in his region. God brought him out and then brought destruction on the region. Only Noah, Daniel, and Job, by their righteousness, says the eternal God. If I cause wild beasts to pass through the land, and they empty it, and make it so desolate that no man may pass through it because of the beasts, even though these three men were in it, as I live, says the Lord, they would deliver neither their sons or daughters, only they would be delivered, and the land would be desolate. Verse 17, or if I bring a sword on the land and say, sword, go through the land, and I cut off man and beast from it, even though these three men were in it as I live, says the eternal God, they would deliver neither their sons or daughters, but only themselves would be delivered. Twice he makes the reference to what happened. God showed extra favor to members' children. God spared Noah's three children and their wives, even though they were unrighteous, because of the righteousness of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, verse 19. Or if I send pestilence into the land and pour out my fury in it in blood and cut off man and beast, even though Noah and Daniel and Job were in it as I live, says the Eternal, they would deliver neither son nor daughter. They would deliver only themselves by their righteousness. All thy commandments are righteousness. Christians watch in part by keeping God's law. It's one of the reasons we emphasize so importantly the need to keep God's law. To keep our priorities right, to make sure that we're not just eating and drinking and buying and selling and marrying and giving in marriage, going about the normal everyday things as if that were an end in itself. That's the way most people live their lives. Those things are an end in themselves. So Noah's righteousness is what's being emphasized. Why was Noah spared? Why did he find grace, favor in God's eyes? Because he was righteous. He was obedient to God. One more New Testament scripture, Hebrews 11. Hebrews 11 and verse 7. Noah is identified as having at least one other characteristic here. Of course, you know Hebrews 11 is the faith chapter, so you can guess what other characteristic Noah must have had as a part of his righteousness. Verse 7, by faith, Noah was a man of righteousness. He was a man of faith. He trusted God. If God said he's going to do it, he knows he'll do it. Timing is up to God, but he knows it's coming. By faith, Noah, being divinely warned of things not yet seen, moved with godly fear. Noah was a man of righteousness, faith, and godly fear. Prepared an ark for the saving of his household, by which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. So we might say very clearly, Noah had at least those three things. He was a man of righteousness, he was a man of faith, he was a man of godly fear. He became heir of righteousness, which is according to faith. Let's go back then to Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6. In verses 8 and 9 again. Verse 8 says, Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal, the only individual in the world. I believe God sometimes allows us to have that experience by being the only one in our circumstance, in our neighborhood, in our city, in our school, at our workplace. We get the Noah feeling very directly sometimes. Noah found grace in the eyes of the Eternal. Verse 9, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man. What else do we learn about Noah? Righteous, faithful, feared God. He was just. You couldn't find a fairer, more equitable person. He was a just man, perfect in his generations. And then it says, Noah walked with God. The only other one that stated in that direct way was Enoch. Enoch walked with God. What does the word just mean? It says Noah was a just man. The word just means lawful, righteous, just. In other words, having justice. Right, correct, lawful. He was an upright man. It also says he was perfect in his generations. Perfect in his generations. The word perfect. Was Noah perfect? Was he without flaw? No. The Hebrew word for perfect is tamim, T-A-M-I-Y-M, tamim. And it means something that is whole or complete, free from objection, intact. Sometimes this word is used for the animal sacrifices that were used. They were tamim, they were unblemished. So you read about the sacrifices, when it says they were unblemished, they were tamim, they were to be tamim. In other words, you look at them, they didn't have to have a pedigree, but you looked at them and they didn't have any obvious flaws. They didn't have scars, they didn't have lameness, they have a broken leg or a deformity of some kind. You looked at them and they were good, they were perfect, they were whole, they were complete, they were intact. Perfect is used 91 times in the Old Testament, but never in conjunction with genealogy. Tamim refers to physically unblemished in animals. And when that word is used for people, it means spiritually unblemished. How do we know that? Well, turn to Genesis chapter 17 and verse 1. Genesis 17 and verse 1. I'll give you a few other references you can jot down and read later. But when it says Noah was perfect in his generations, it means he was morally upright. In fact, that's the way some translate it. That's a contrast, and this is a specific point. It's a direct contrast to the rest of humanity being corrupt. Noah, on the other hand, corrupt, we said, was morally degenerate, morally decayed. Noah, on the other hand, was morally upright. He was perfect in his generations. When God looked at the earth, here's the one that stood out. Genesis 17, verse 1. Talking to Abraham, God says this, I am, Genesis 17, 1, I am Almighty God, walk before me and be tamim, be blameless. Be morally upright. That's what God was asking of Abraham. Be morally upright. So we have the world as corrupt. We have Noah as morally uncorrupt, morally upright. So it doesn't mean that he was perfect in the sense of without any flaw whatsoever, without any sin, because we see Noah after the flood, and did Noah have sin? Yeah, Noah got drunk as soon as the flood was finished, basically. So he wasn't a perfect man in the sense of without any flaw whatsoever, but he was morally upright. And that should give us great comfort as well, because we want to be morally upright. That doesn't mean we're perfect, but we are morally upright, trying to do what God says to the best of our ability. Now you can jot down, if you'd like, Deuteronomy chapter 18 and verse 13, where God says, you shall be blameless before the Lord. Tamim, you shall be morally upright. You shall be on the upside, not the downside. Joshua 24, verse 14. Joshua 24, verse 14. Now therefore, fear the Eternal, serve Him in sincerity. That's the word tamim, sincerity. It's translated sincerity there. Serve the Lord in moral uprightness. That's what it means. And in truth. You can also jot down David's psalm in 2 Samuel chapter 22. 2 Sam 22:24. Lots of twos in that. 2 Samuel 22:24. David wrote this. He's writing about himself, was also blameless, tamim, before him. Morally upright. Doesn't mean he was without sin, without any imperfection. But he was morally upright. I was also blameless before him, and I kept myself from iniquity. So tamim, or perfect, back in Genesis 6, does not refer to a sinless state, but it does indicate being morally and spiritually upright before God. And every time tamim is used for a human being, it means morally upright. And that's the context each time. Of the 91 times it's used, when it's used about people, it's always moral uprightness. So, perfect in his generations simply means that in his time, he was the one. In his time, he was the morally upright one, contrasted with everybody else who was corrupt, morally upright versus corrupt. That's the juxtaposition there of the two phrases in Genesis 6. So perfect in his generations means that he was morally upright in his time period. That's why he was spared. He was righteous, he feared God, he was faithful, and as a result he found grace in the eyes of God and he was spared. That's confirmed by the statement, of course, at the end of verse 8, in verse 9 I should say, that Noah walked with God. Let's look at one final scripture in Colossians chapter 1, verse 9. Colossians chapter 1, in verse 9. Because we'll see that the Apostle Paul gives similar encouragement. Says Noah walked with God, he was just, and he was morally upright, he was perfect in his generations. Out of all the humans, he was the one that was, quote-unquote, tamim, while the others were corrupt. Colossians 1:9 gives us that same encouragement, where we need to likewise be like Noah. For this reason, Paul writes, Colossians 1, verse 9. For this reason, we also, since the day we heard it, do not cease to pray for you and ask that you may be filled with the knowledge of His will in all wisdom and spiritual understanding. That's what Paul hoped for God's people. Why? Why did he want God's people filled with knowledge, with wisdom, with spiritual understanding, verse 10, that you may walk? Noah was righteous, he was just, he feared God, and therefore he walked with the Lord. That's what we're asking. Paul says, I'm praying for you that you're filled with knowledge, spiritual understanding, so that, verse 10, you may walk worthy of the Lord, fully pleasing Him, being fruitful in every good work and increasing in the knowledge of God. Like the darkness in the cave, today God has lights, His people that He has called to be the light of the world. So even though there can be a situation of complete darkness, there's still light available. And that's our calling, brethren, to be like Noah, to provide light to the world, to show how it can be done, to bring light to people's lives. They may not accept it now, they may not understand it now, but they'll know that something is good there, something is right, something's different. And of course, isn't it interesting that at the end time, we're told that how will the world survive? Will survive because there are those who have found grace in the eyes of the eternal. Turn back to Matthew chapter 24 one last time. Matthew 24. In talking about the very troubled times that are yet ahead. We learn likewise that there will be a great tribulation. There is coming a time, a snare upon the world that will take them all by surprise. People say, well, look at the world now. I don't see that. Well, you don't see a snare. You don't see a trap. Verse 11 says, there are many, then many false prophets will rise up and deceive many. Because lawlessness will abound, the love of many will wax cold or grow cold. But he who endures to the end shall be saved. And this gospel of him will be preached in all the world as a witness to all nations. And then the end will come. So we have a responsibility today to preach that gospel, to take this truth to the world, to be a preacher of righteousness. So that when the end does come, people will say, well, we were warned. We didn't have an excuse. So, brethren, let's learn what we can from the days of Noah. Learn that the end time and the days of Noah are alike. And most importantly, let's strive to be like Noah himself.